prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
It's like a battlefield.
There's a battle for the soul of America.
We can't let him tear the kingdom down.
This is no game. This is war.
Flesh and blood. But it's between the bad and good. We can't stop until the trumpets sound. This is war. Not a game we're playing. This is a war.
The only question is, which side will you be on? It's time now for a call to decision with Pastor Butch Paul.
Satan's armies come to kill. This is war.
Hello and welcome, my friends. This is Pastor Butch Paul, 2 January 2021. Welcome to tonight's program. Boy, you are in for a treat tonight. We're going to bring on a guest that I've only got to speak to maybe 3 or 4 times total ever since I knew of him. His name is Edwin Vieira. Wow. When you get to talk to this man, it makes you feel like you're almost like a mental midget. But he's absolutely phenomenal. We'll share a little bit about him in a minute, and we're going to bring up and share some thoughts tonight on what's happening in this country financially and around the world, and maybe the global reset. Before I do that, though, don't forget, folks, we're still offering the special, the special on the REM sleep and the Tranquil, as long as our supplier says do it. You can get both bottles for $38.95. Regular price is almost $50, $58 actually. But $38.95 will get you 2 bottles, the same one or one of each, whatever you want to do with that. It's available. And we're still offering the teaching, 2-hour teaching from the mask to the mark. And folks, I urge you with everything in me, get a copy of that. Make all the copies you want. There's nothing copyright about them. Get all the copies you want and share with your friends and family. Please do that. Donation of $10.50 for a DVD, which I'd recommend DVD because we do show some things on that you want to see, some pictures of what I'm talking about. We also have available on CD if you want it. It's up to you on that. And, of course, the 90-page information that I just printed off on the Rothschild family. I think you'll find this very interesting. 90 pages, folks. It's a $20 donation. I mean, pretty expensive to print off, ship it out of here. But I want you to have that to share it with the family also because it's important. And don't forget, if you're listening on 6115 Melody Seedstrom, with discount gold silver, pays for the airtime on shortwave right now on 6115. And if you listen on 6115, and it's not coming too well, 11 o'clock Eastern tonight, go to 3215 shortwave and check it out there. Make them a little better, okay? We always do a rebroadcast at 11 o'clock at night of the one that goes on at 8, so you're welcome to join us if you can. But instead, our guest tonight is Edwin Vieira, and I'll read to you a little bit of his bio. This is a little bit. And I want you to listen to this man's qualifications. Edwin Vieira Jr. holds 4 degrees from Harvard, AB, Harvard College, and AM and PhD, Harvard Graduate School of Arts and Sciences, and JD, Harvard Law School. For more than 30 years, he has practiced law with emphasis on constitutional issues. He is also one of our country's most eminent constitutional attorneys, having brought 4 cases that were accepted by the Supreme Court and having won 3 of them. Wow, what a record. In the Supreme Court of the United States, he successfully argued or briefed the cases leading to the landmark decisions Abode versus Detroit Board of Education, Chicago Teacher Union versus Hudson, and Communications Workers of America versus Beck, which established constitutional and statutory limitations on these uses to which labor unions in both the private and the public sectors may apply fees extracted from non-union workers as a condition of their employment. He's the world's most foremost authority about the role of our Constitution as it relates to money. That's what I'm talking about tonight, folks, our financial system. And has written numerous monographs and articles in scholarly journals schools and lectured throughout the country. His most recent work on money and banking is the two-volume pieces of The Pieces of Eight, The Monetary Powers and Disabilities of the United States Constitution, the most comprehensive study in existence of America, American Monetary Law and History Reviewed from a Constitutional Perspective. He also is a co-author, under nom de plume, the political novel Christmaster, A Federal Affair, A Not-So-Fictional Story of an Endangered Christ of the Federal Reserve System and the Political Upheaval Causes. Now, folks, this, his latest book, by the way, up to this article here, is How to Dethrone the Imperial Judiciary. Edwin Vieira is a man, when I do get a chance to talk to him, which is very rare, is stimulating. Very few people, folks, that are, I know that listen like you all do, I understand what we're talking about. Very few people do this. Edwin does and more. And it's an honor to have him join us tonight. Edwin Vieira, are you there?
Yes, I am, Pastor. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you, sir, and I mean that. I really enjoyed the conversation. I could talk to you for hours and pick your brain. I really could, because you put a lot of time and a lot of effort into doing what you do and understand what's going on. And the Constitution and all that's important, but we're going to discuss tonight something that has to do with affects all of us. The monetary situation, the bailouts of the trillions of dollars of spending to give people money for COVID and bailing out businesses and giving it to whatever, they're just printing paper. That's what they're doing and passing out. And of course, it's called inflation. We see that coming. We see the dollar collapsing around the world. We see a lot more than that. We have the people talking about the Great Reset. I'd like to discuss that with you in a little bit too, about what's coming there. And Edwin, America is beyond help as far as paying off our debt. That's not going to happen. The only way we'd fix it is go back to what we're supposed to have, a constitutional form of government and money system, and which is also biblical. But I don't see that happening. I'd like for you, if you would, tell the folks about who Edwin is, other than what I've already said, and then we'll get into this discussion. I want you to feel free to share tonight what's on your mind, because people do care. But tell me who Edwin Vieira is and how long you practice law and what all you've done.
Well, on the monetary issue, let's go back to the 1980s, older people may remember that period. And there
now,
was
now,
a
you
United
know you're
States.
You're talking about me, right? You're talking about
well,
me. I remember
perhaps myself as well. Ron Paul, for instance, in Congress, there was a United States Gold Commission that was set up. And the ostensible purpose was to investigate whether there was a role for gold to be introduced within the monetary system. Because people may remember when Franklin Roosevelt came in 1933, one of the first things that he did in the course of what was then the banking collapse that had been going on for a couple of years, actually, they closed the banks, and then he instituted the gold seizure program, the repudiation of the gold clause contracts, those contracts that were payable in gold, and ostensibly took the United States, at least domestically, off what was called the gold standard.
Right.
And one may remember that at that point in time, or just prior to that, Federal Reserve notes had been redeemable in gold. The Federal Reserve system was initially a gold-based fractional reserve banking system. So Roosevelt removed the gold reserve requirements from the Federal Reserve domestically, but they were maintained internationally so that foreign holders of Federal Reserve notes could come to the Treasury and demand redemption of those notes in gold. Now, that didn't make much of a difference economically here during the 30s, and certainly during the 40s, the early 40s at least, because World War II was going on. And at the end of World War II, the United States had, we think, the largest gold stock of any country in the world, because a lot of gold, of course, had come here, certainly from England and other places, to purchase war supplies and other things during the war. So as a result, the United States Treasury / Federal Reserve, because they are, in a sense, Siamese twins, joined together, they were in a position to dominate world monetary policy and world finance. And that was essentially codified in the Bretton Woods Agreement, which was in the late 40s, making making the Federal Reserve System essentially the world central bank, the first world central bank, at least of modern times.
Now, I did not know that. That's an interesting point. I did not know that. I had no idea. So,
right.
So we were the nation they centered in. Okay.
And this was simply because of the way international finance had worked out as a result of the war. England, before the war, the Bank of England had been a very powerful financial entity in world economics, probably a little more powerful than the Federal Reserve System was. World War I had seriously undermined British finance. World War II collapsed it. And so the Federal Reserve took over the leading role as the international financial coordinator, if you will. And I say coordinator because, of course, the Federal Reserve didn't have any direct legal authority over other countries to tell them what to do in terms of finance or monetary policy. But it was simply a practical matter. The United States had this huge, powerful economy. Our financial system was still strong, even though domestically we were off the gold, so-called gold standard. Internationally, we were still paying gold to people who were redeeming Federal Reserve notes. And we were pretty much the only major country, the only major country, I think, maybe Brazil, you call that a major country, Argentina, that had come out of the war without, you know, domestic devastation as a result of being bombed or over, you know, fighting going on within that territory. So that was the position of the Federal Reserve System at that time. Between, let's say, the Eisenhower years, which is, 53, and Nixon, there was a major run on the gold stock of the United States, foreign countries redeeming Federal Reserve currency for gold. And quite a bit of this is reputed to have been encouraged or engaged in by Charles de Gaulle, the French government under de Gaulle, because his advisors recognized that the Federal Reserve System was essentially an engine of inflation and was even then engaged in inflationary policies, and that the best thing to do to protect those other countries, France as an example, was to take their Federal Reserve note holdings and convert them into gold. Well, that became a hemorrhaging operation, essentially. Gold was flowing out of the Treasury far too fast for the Treasury officials and the people behind them, or major American bankers, to tolerate. And so they prevailed upon President Nixon to, as the expression went, close the gold window. He simply said, well, we're not going to pay any more gold internationally. And at that point, the Federal Reserve note became what we call a fiat
yes.
currency.
Yes.
Fiat meaning let it be, right? Let it be money. It really isn't, but let's treat it as if it is. So you look back historically, when the Federal Reserve System was created in 1913, Federal Reserve notes were redeemable in gold domestically. Comes in Roosevelt, Federal Reserve notes go off of gold, so we have a partial fiat currency here in the United States. We still had silver circulating, by the way. Comes the Nixon, Johnson-Nixon era, the first thing that, I mean, we had Johnson ended the role of silver in the economy. Nixon ends the role of gold internationally, and so now Federal Reserve notes in terms of gold, so-called gold standard, are a fiat currency domestically and internationally. So now this brings us to the Gold Commission in the early 1980s. And this thing was set up for the ostensible purpose of seeing whether there was an actual role for gold that could be, you know, legislated again. The real reason it happened, the practical reason that it happened, was because of the Black Caucus in Congress. I suppose people know what that is.
Yes.
Those are the Black Americans, African Americans, whatever they would be called, who were in Congress then as representatives, and they were very concerned that the leading gold coin in the world at the time was the Krugerrand. Krugerrands, of course, were minted where? In South Africa.
Africa, yes.
South Africa. And South Africa at that time had the so-called apartheid system, a kind of racial segregation system involving different tribes of Africans and the Boers, people who had been the Boers, the white South Africans, Afrikaners. And that was looked upon as an unacceptable social and political system. And the Black Caucus was obviously very concerned about it. And what they wanted to do was to dethrone, as it were, the Krugerrand from its preeminent position as a world used, as a gold coin that was circulating throughout the world. Primarily people were buying the Krugerrands to put in safety deposit boxes as an investment. But it was the major one that was selling. So the idea that the Black Caucus wanted to promote was, let's create an American coin that will compete with this South African coin and maybe do its serious damage and thus undermine, at least to that extent, the apartheid system. So there was really this political impetus behind it. It wasn't that much that people were very concerned about the monetary aspects of this, but there was a powerful lobby within Congress, the Black Caucus, that had another agenda, another political agenda. And so they promoted this. Well, in any event, it was held. And not very much came out of it in terms of real monetary reform. What it finally decided was that a gold coin should be produced and a silver coin should be produced out of the Treasury. So now we had, and it's actually a set, really, have a set of gold coins, American Eagle gold coins, and most people are familiar with those, the 1 ounce, the half ounce, so forth. And then the Liberty silver dollar, so-called, not actually a constitutional dollar because it didn't quite have the right weight. But you had those two new specie coins, gold and silver coins, which would be put out by the Treasury, still being put out by the Treasury, to go into general circulation, although people don't actually use them as day-to-day currency. So that was the result of it. Ron Paul, of course, was on that. Louis Lehrman, an economist from New York, was on it, and they wrote a minority view that went further than simply the creation of a new gold coin. Now, my involvement was that I came in to talk to Ron Paul about a case that I had going on in Maryland with an individual who wanted to promote silver coinage, United States silver coinage. We'll get into the details of that because it's kind of a complicated thing. But anyway, I came in to talk to him about it, and I began talking with some of the staffers about what was going on in the Gold Commission. And at one point I said to them, well, what do you folks have? What has been put in that deals with the constitutional questions of how gold and silver are involved in our monetary system at that level, at that legal level, constitutional level? And they said, well, there really wasn't anything. And I said to them, because I was a little peeved by that, I said, well, how can you people be talking anything but nonsense about this if you don't know what the constitutional basis, pro and con, might be about
absolutely
the use of gold and silver in our monetary system, right? It seemed to me ridiculous that you could be having discussions without having this kind of legal premise established. So they came back to me and they said, well, if you think that's so important, why don't you write something? So I did. I wrote it. It was about 60 pages long. And it was an outline more than anything else. I couldn't go into too much detail, you know, when you're sending something to a congressional committee, or in this case, a commission. And I put it in, and unfortunately, it came in at a point in time where it was too late for me to be put on the last list of witnesses to testify about it. So it was introduced. I didn't get to testify about it. If one goes and searches the records there, and I did many years ago just to see, it's there. You know, it's along with the Ark of the Covenant, if you know what I mean, way in the back of the room somewhere, hidden. Well, in any event, I came back to Ron Paul's office a month or so later, and they said, oh, that was very good. That was an excellent piece of work. Why don't I, publish it? And I thought to myself, well, I could have put a lot more into it if it hadn't been for, you know, to be given to this commission. So I said, well, what I'll do is I'll just expand a little bit. So that was the first edition of the book called Pieces of Eight. And the reason it's called Pieces of Eight is because the United States silver dollar is based upon the Spanish coin, the Piece of Eight. That was 383 pages long.
Wow.
It came out in 1983.
Wow.
And then over the years, I just collected more material and decided, well, finally, I'm going to do something really definitive. I'll write the book that no one else will go beyond. And now it's about 1,700 pages, two volumes. I went into a lot more detail. The upshot of this is that they've made a bloody mess of the monetary system, and not just recently. I mean, it's been going on throughout the 1800s and, of course, the 1900s last century, and now it's just gone over the edge. And the basic problem was the distinction between government money and private money. And the idea of government money was we were going to have an absolute, unchanging standard monetary unit. And it turned out, way back in the time of the Founding Fathers, to the Articles of Confederation and then under the Constitution, that the standard that was adopted was the Spanish milled dollar, the so-called Piece of Eight. And the reason they called it the Piece of Eight is because it was typical in those days that people would cut those coins into eight pieces to make change. And they didn't have a very sophisticated coin system. And that's where the concept two bits, each one of those eight pieces was called a bit. Two bits was a quarter, four bits was a half. Right, six bits
three quarters,
eight bits was a dollar. Okay, that's where we get the two bits slang. And for a long time, Wall Street stock prices were quoted in what bits? Right, 1/8, 1/4, 3/8, 1/2. Right, those are the price of stock. 102 and an eighth. Why was that? Because that went back historically to the way they were quoted when the Spanish mill dollar was being used as the primary coin.
Wow, that's interesting. Interesting.
Well, the history of this is fascinating because you see how far away these people have gotten. And at the time of the Articles of Confederation Congress, they were looking for this monetary standard, the unchanging unit of money around which the entire economy would circulate. And they picked the Spanish mill dollar for the simple reason that that was the coin that was ubiquitous in the colonies and then the independent states. Because we had, of course, British money, the pound, the shilling, but there was a large amount of trade going on between the 13 colonies and Spanish America, the Caribbean and Spanish America, and that was done in primarily in dollars. So, in fact, in 1704, so it tells you how far back this went, 1704, Queen Anne, Queen of Britain, they passed a proclamation and a statute that made the Spanish mill dollar the unit within the colonies for all foreign coinage. So by the time they get to the War of Independence, you have the Continental Congress, they're looking to do essentially the same thing. What are we going to choose? And the answer was, these were practical people, of course, the answer was we'll use what the market is using. And the market was using the Spanish mill dollar. So they adopted the Spanish mill dollar under the Continental Congress. And then under the Constitution, had an interesting situation where Hamilton was the Secretary of the Treasury, and Jefferson was the Secretary of State. Now, these two fellows didn't agree on very much. Jefferson was the, what I would call the rural Democrat. He believed in the people and not the elites. And Hamilton was exactly the opposite. He believed in the elites and not the people. He wanted more centralized government. Jefferson was for decentralized government. But the two of them agreed on what had to be the unit of money in the country. It had to be the unit that was being used by the market. We were not going to derange the whole economic system and create something absolutely new. And they agreed that what needed to be done was to find out, well, what does this coin, what is its value? And value in those days meant how much silver did it contain, because it's a silver coin. And they brought in some merchants, some professional men. And those people did what we call statistical analysis. They went to the marketplace, and they pulled coins of various states of wear, some that were more or less pristine, some of them were, that were worn to the point at which they no longer circulated by hand. People would turn them in and be melted. And they did a statistical analysis by melting the coins down, finding how much silver was in the melt, and dividing it by the number of coins that they had melted. And they came up with the number 371 1/4 grains of pure silver in the average Spanish mill dollar, and that is the constitutional American dollar. Mintage Act.
Wow.
Okay, first Mintage Act.
I'd like to interject one thing here, too, that I do some teachings on this. I have a church service and things showing people lawful money, biblical money, and constitutional money. And on a bill, I have a 1954 $100 bill. And this is, and I also have a $20 bill that says this. And this is what gets your attention. And as, of course, it says this is a legal tender for all debts, public and private. It goes on to say, though, this is redeemable in lawful money. What they're saying is this piece of paper is not lawful money, but you deem them a lawful money to bank.
Well, that's exactly the development. And it's a distinction between constitutional money, this absolute unit which is not supposed to change and which you can hold in your hand, and which is limited, actually, in its production, because if you think it through, the only way that kind of money comes into existence is that somebody has to go find it, mine it, refine it, and eventually take it to the treasury, because the mint in the treasury is the one responsible for coining the money, and have the treasury coin silver dollars out of it. And the system that was originally developed was called free coinage. You brought the silver to the mint would coin it at no cost to you. Or if you wanted to get your money immediately, didn't want to wait for the minting process, then it would give you some coinage with a deduction because of the time element. So the market controlled the amount of money that was created, because U.S. government certainly didn't have large silver mines, for instance, that it was using to generate money. The market controlled it. And money, or let's say silver, the mining of silver, is competing with all sorts of other endeavors. You're talking about the land, you're talking about the workers, you're talking about the machines. All of these things can be used in other ways. Investment could go in other directions. So the market would determine how much silver was going to be produced, and of that silver, how much was going to go to the mint, as opposed to going into people's teeth, or today into electronics, or whatever other uses of that metal might be that were not monetary. So you had a system with a absolutely fixed unit, the amount of which was ultimately to be determined by the economy, not by politicians and not by bankers.
All right, hang on to your thought through this break, please. Hang on through the break. After the break, folks, we're going to find out what happened. Why they took silver out of a dollar in 1964. What happened? Why did they change this? Don't go away. A lot more if you have any questions, comments, join us at 844-769-2944. 844-769-2944.
Seeking souls of fallen men. 5 years ago, I had such chronic back pain that at one point I bought 3 mattresses within an 18-month period, hoping to relieve my lower back pain. I was only 40, and I hiked daily along with eating a fairly healthy diet. I was not overweight and didn't really have a reason for my back pain. As soon as I started using 3 sprays of Synergy One each morning, the pain immediately went away, and I've never had it again. I also use Synergy One before bed for a better night's sleep. Whenever my mom has back pain, I remind her to use Synergy One. Sure enough, she's all better after using it. I've probably given over 10 bottles away to friends with back pain. I take it when I travel and never miss a day.
Raising growth hormone levels to a more youthful level consistently results in deeper sleep, better energy and mood, fat loss, and the elimination of pain through the repair of injuries. Synergy One is guaranteed to improve the health of your body or your money back. Call 888-988-3325. That's 888-988-3325. Or visit synergisticuniverse.com.
Hello, folks. Pastor Butch here to tell you about our newest sponsor, a store food company that truly surpasses all the others for quality and flavor. Numana Storable Foods, the only storable food manufacturer that has all their foods grown in the USA. They are GMO-free, have no artificial sweeteners, no high fructose corn syrup, no MSGs, no chemical preservatives, and no soy. They are simply the best storable foods available for all the right reasons. Go to Nemana.com or call 888-597-0775 and mention code Pastor Butch to get 10% off your merchandise. Again, Numana.com or call 888-597-0775. Mention code Pastor Butch for a 10% discount.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
This is war, not a game we're playing. This is a war.
Folks, I hope this conversation is fascinating you to it is to me tonight. This is fascinating to me. You know, I was just talking to Edwin during the break there, and I made a statement that ignorance is the breeding ground for slavery. And I didn't more think about thinking that was pretty good, because it really is. If you don't know what real money is, how do you know when they take it from you? When they take away the precious metals, the back, the paper dollar, and tell you everything's just fine, nothing's changed, it's still worth the same thing. If we believe that, and as a nation we did, shame on us. Shame on us. The public fool system has done a very good job of de-educating the children and making ignorant robots out of them. Please, Edwin, go ahead and tell us sometime along the way here how they conned us out of the last bit of real money, the silver that we had back in 1964. Go ahead.
Well, that's exactly what I'm going to get into next. So we started off with a system with an absolute unit in which the market controlled the supply of money. And this was true both of gold and silver, because gold and silver were part of the system simultaneously. But we also had banking operations. And the banking operations were operating on the fractional reserve system, which meant depositor would put in, let's say, 100 silver dollars, and the banks would open an account for him. He could write checks, or maybe they'd give him what were called banknotes, promissory notes from the bank to pay someone so many dollars. Those pieces of paper were not dollars. They were promises to pay dollars. There's a big difference.
Right.
And what the banks would do is they would take that $100 and they would lend out some amount of it, because that's how they made their money. Right? They lended interest. And they could get away with that because they determined that if they held $100 in their depository, those people who actually had a claim on those coins would probably be perfectly willing not to make that claim all at once. You know, they take a certain amount out, and then they might deposit some more in and so forth and so on. They write a check here and whatever. But the banks only had to keep a percentage, a fractional amount of the total deposits in order to satisfy those depositors most of the time, and they could lend the rest out. Now, the difficulty came when that lending policy became imprudent. The banks made bad loans, or the economy went into a depression, recession, whatever term they would be using, because of various economic factors. And the banks suddenly discovered that those loans were bad in the sense that they weren't being paid back, or the interest on them wasn't being paid, or what have you. And then the depositors would come to the banks and say, "Where's my $100? And the banks didn't have it. You'd have bank runs, bank closures. The classic example of this goes in the early 1930s, pictures which are easy enough to find on the internet, of huge lines of depositors going around the block from some bank, each one waiting to get in to see if the bank had enough to meet his withdrawal demands. Now, this kind of thing went on throughout the 1800s. Over and over again, there were these examples of bank failures, bank stringencies, panics, they used to call them, financial panics. And it was thought, actually by Hamilton, starting with Hamilton, that if there was some kind of what we now call central bank that could oversee in some way the operations of all the other banks, that this unfortunate process could be controlled, or at least ameliorated. Now, not be able to stop it, but it wouldn't result in really chaotic situations developing. So there was the First Bank of the United States, and that was not quite like the Federal Reserve because it was a private entity all of its own, and it really had no direct control over other private banks. And that failed. And then the Second Bank of the United States, and that operated at the time of General Jackson. Andrew Jackson became president, famous bank fight, because the Jacksonians were very much against paper money. They thought paper money was a scheme for robbing the average man. And so he wanted to destroy the Second Bank of the United States, and he accomplished it, actually, politically he accomplished
it. Yes, he did.
And then there was a period of time when the Treasury ran its own, essentially, banking operations for the government. It didn't deposit its money in the private banks. Well, that comes all the way up to the war, the Civil War. And the Civil War was a very unpopular war, at least on the Union side, to a large extent. And very high taxes were being raised in order to pay the war expenditures. So the Union government, the Lincoln administration, came up with the idea of the United States note, which was a new form of indebtedness which would serve as hand-to-hand money. And it happened to be printed on one side with green ink, and that's where the concept greenback comes from.
Uh-huh.
Since 1862, Congress issued, the first issue was in 1862, a certain amount of these things, dollar valuation, a couple more during the war. And at the time, they were not redeemable. They were supposed to be redeemable in principle, but during the war, there was no redemption because the war was on. It's an emergency situation. The government wasn't paying out gold or silver. So these things circulated as a true fiat currency. They had no redemption value through the Treasury. And they depreciated about 67%, I think, was the maximum depreciation of these things. Well, the war ended, and they then developed kind of a three-way conflict in the monetary system. There were people who said, we don't ever want to go back to these greenbacks. Look at this inflationary damage that they've done, and this thing simply results in the politicians being able to manipulate the financial system. We don't want that to happen. On the other side, there were people who believed in paper currency. They wanted more of it to be issued. So that was settled by saying, well, we won't issue any more, but when this original paper currency comes back to the Treasury will just spend it again. It will continue to circulate. We'll never get rid of it. Then there was the banking question. What were the bankers going to get out of this? And during the war, 1863 and 1864, they got the national banking system, which is still with us, by the way. It's part of the Federal Reserve System. The national banking system was a kind of Hamiltonian idea to tie the banks and the big financial houses behind the banks very closely into the Treasury. So what the banks had to do was they had to deposit, they had to buy U.S. bonds, and then they had to deposit those bonds with the Treasury, and the Treasury would give them 90% of the value of the bonds in national bank currency, and then the banks could loan that and make money. So there was a direct connection between the banks and the Treasury, much more so than even under the First and Second Bank of the United States. Now, the problem with that from the bankers' point of view was they were limited. They had to buy this government debt in order to be able to get their hands on the currency that they wanted to run their loan operations. And at that time, people were not interested, the American people were not interested in wildly expanding the amount of government debt. They already had a tremendous amount of government debt hanging over them from the Civil War. So the national banking system really didn't do what the bankers wanted to do, and it certainly didn't stabilize the economy, because there were a number of banking crises that went on from the end of the Civil War until the early 1900s. So by the time of the early 1900s, they're beginning to think about, how are we going to bring this whole system under control? And the answer was, well, we need a lender of last resort. The real problem here is that the banks get themselves overextended. They make bad loans. And then they find themselves in need of loans for their own operations. We have to be able to bail them out, as we call it today. We have to have a bailout system of some kind to keep the banking system from collapsing. Now, it would have been much smarter to control the fractional reserve system, but you can't do this anymore. Right? You can't generate currency that way. But they didn't. The bankers pulled, they were pulling the strings on the politicians, as usual. So they came up with a system called the Federal Reserve. And the Federal Reserve actually incorporates all these national banks. They still exist. It has 12 Federal Reserve regional banks, which are federal corporations. And then within each of those regions, they have commercial banks and state banks, which are member banks of the Federal Reserve System. And at the top of this operation is the all-seeing eye, in a sense. It's the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, appointed by the President and confirmed by the Senate. And then they have the Federal Open Market Committee, which is where the real work is done, and that's some of the officials from the private banks, and then the Board of Governors, and they sit around and they determine bank policy, primarily interest rates, various types of interest rates. And so they are now controlling the emission of currency. And some of it may be paper. They can go to the U.S. Treasury and ask the Treasury to print Federal Reserve notes up to a certain point. The Board of Governors controls that. Or it can simply be what I would call electronic currency, bank deposits, which people can transfer by check, or they can transfer electronically. They never touch any currency. But those deposits are considered to be, quote-unquote, money. Hmm. And this whole thing operates ultimately on the basis of debt. The Federal Reserve note, as I said before, in 1913, had to be redeemed in gold. It stopped redemption of the Federal Reserve note in gold in the 30s. The banks used to redeem Federal Reserve notes in silver. I remember many times as a youngster going into a bank.
Yes.
Here's a $5 bill. Give me five silver dollars, typical Morgan silver dollars, or some of the Liberty silver dollars. Then, of course, silver was removed from the system, and that started with John Kennedy, and then it was finished with Lyndon Johnson. And the reason they removed gold and silver from the system was, as I said before, there's a limited amount of gold and silver that comes out of the ground and goes into money. The market controls it. You don't have unlimited resources of gold and silver flooding into the treasury. But the banks would like to be able to operate, certainly the government would like to be able to operate, with unlimited amounts of money at hand. So using gold and silver as the absolute monetary standard was always very restrictive on the ability of the banks to function, and it was restrictive on the ability of the governments to function, because how were governments going to pay their debts unless they taxed people to get the gold and silver, and high taxes would result in politicians losing the next election. So the governments didn't want to have restrictions based upon an absolute fixed type of currency. The banks certainly didn't want that to happen. They ended up creating the Federal Reserve on that pretense. But as soon as they had the first major banking problem, and remember, the Federal Reserve system comes in 1913. There was a depression in 1920 and 21 after World War One. That was a small one.
Right.
Then the biggest depression in the history of the world came in 1932-33. And the Federal Reserve System had been promoted on the basis that it was going to be run on scientific principles, and it would be the end of depression, it would be the end of inflation. If you go back and look at the history of this thing, this is what they were selling. And within 20 years, they had the greatest depression the world has ever seen. All right, and now we're en route to the greatest inflation the world has ever seen. We'll get to that in a moment. So this was the impetus for taking gold out of the system, because they wanted to inflate the currency, and gold was a limitation on the Federal Reserve note. And that didn't work because they had to pay gold internationally, and so they had to stop the payment of gold under Nixon. So now gold was completely removed. Silver, the Federal Reserve banks never were required to pay in silver. They were required to pay in gold, all lawful money. And so gold was taken out. What was lawful money? Well, lawful money was anything that was out there that Congress has said was money. And it would have been silver dollars, the small change that was still in silver, made out of silver, notes, treasury notes, silver certificates. You can run down a list. And so there was a time until actually Johnson, Lyndon Johnson as president, when silver was circulating and Federal Reserve notes were being exchanged freely for silver. And that was too much, too. They recognized that there was a very large demand on silver, and so Johnson stopped the use of silver. So at that point, we had, and then Nixon, of course, next stopped international gold payments. So at that point, by the time we get to Nixon, we now have the Federal Reserve note is a true, almost fiat currency, because you can still go to the banks and they'll give you some junk coinage, what I call junk coinage. It's made out of base metals, silver, Susan B. Anthony coins, the state quarters, and so forth and so on, right? So they'll still give you that. And that is still, quote-unquote, lawful money because it's been minted by the Treasury. There's a statute that provides for it. But it's not tied in any way, number one, to gold or silver. And it's really not tied in any way to market control, because most people don't carry bags of quarters around or Susan B. Anthony dollars or whatever. It simply isn't used that way. And they certainly don't put quarters and Susan B. Anthony dollars away in a safety deposit box as investments, right, which they used to do with gold and probably still do with American gold and silver coins. So that brings us up then to the Gold Commission, which I was mentioning earlier. And the interesting thing there was, as I said before, the real impetus behind it was the Black Caucus. This was a political thing that was going on. But the powers that be, behind the scenes, were not particularly worried that a new gold coin, or set of gold coins, actually, and a new silver coin were going to be minted, because they realized in the 1980s that the average American had no idea of how to differentiate economically and politically, too, between paper money, bank money on the one side, and gold and silver coinage on the other.
And there's a problem. Ignorance of the people, that's the problem. Please go ahead. That's very good. Yes.
No, well, that's exactly right, because one might have thought, oh, this would be very dangerous to the bankers and the politicians if the Treasury were putting out gold and people were in very large numbers using these gold and silver coins instead of Federal Reserve notes. And if banks were now being set up that would have gold and silver coin accounts, right? You might have a two-tier monetary system, and that might move the people in a direction away from the Federal Reserve note banks and away from the big spending politicians. Oh, you can have all sorts of economic and political controversy. We don't want that, right? We want this thing controlled by the elite. This is a Hamiltonian theory. We want the big shots on Wall Street and the big bankers and the politicians, especially the people in the Treasury Department, to be all singing the same tune, as the expression goes, right? They're all working together, and to heck with the average person. The deplorables get what's left over after the elite take what they want.
Yes.
That's the way this thing is supposed to operate. That's a Hamiltonian system. All right, so they weren't concerned about that possibility, and therefore they let the gold and silver legislation through. And so as a result of that, you now have, and have had since the 80s, 1980s, an alternative gold and silver coinage system sitting out there, and people typically buy those coins, exchange Federal Reserve notes for those coins, and then put those coins in a safety deposit box or whatever, some safe place, using them as an investment hedge against inflation. And by inflation, the average person thinks of depreciation in the purchasing power of paper money. The value of paper money goes down. And when it goes down, typically speaking, the value of gold and silver go up. see, the inflation in economic terms simply means increase in the supply of money. And you could have a situation where the supply of money increases and the supply of goods changes commensurate with that, and therefore the prices don't change. Okay? You get the same price for automobiles. Okay? But that's very rare, historically speaking. Typically what happens with inflationary events, large increases in the supply of money results in depreciation of the value of money and large increases in the price of the same good, not a better good. Because it takes
and that
more.
Brings up to the day with the trillions are printing to give out for the COVID hoax. I mean, they're putting out trillions of dollars handed out like candy. And that's, okay, that explains why.
Ah, well, that's right. So now we come to this situation and we look at it and we say, okay, the government in this particular instance has a need for more money because they've created this impossible economic situation, driven people out of work or minimized their ability to earn or what have you, and these people are desperate for income. So what are you going to do? We're going to give them handouts of one kind or another. Where do we get that? Well, if we had to get that in the gold or silver system, we'd be up the creek without a paddle, right? You couldn't generate it that fast. It'd be impossible. However, we now have a fictional money system, a fraudulent money system. And they can create as much as they want, in a sense, electronically. People don't even see the cash.
No, right? They don't.
They send you a deposit to your bank account. All of a sudden, your bank account has an extra $600, $1,200, whatever. Now, what are they saying? Another $1,000? I don't know. $2,000, whatever the numbers are. This just appears out of nowhere. And it goes on the books of the Federal Reserve System, which is generating this, as an increase in the national debt. Well, at a certain point, the national debt becomes irrelevant because it can't be paid. Or I should say, put it this way, all debts are always paid. Either the debtor pays them, or the creditor pays them. Or maybe there might be some third party that comes in, some insurer. But take the typical situation as a debtor. Debtor owns the creditor $100. Either the debtor pays the $100 or the debtor defaults, in which case the creditor loses the $100. He's the one that pays the debt. Debts are always paid. Somebody ends up with that burden, with that financial burden. So you look at this huge...
We're down to the last 5 minutes. So I'd like to get to the reset, too, if I could, very quickly. Because this is so powerful. What you see coming
with that? Well, the Great Reset is an attempt to deal with the recognition on the part of international finance that the role of the Federal Reserve System as the world central bank is at an end. Right? This is a destabilized system which cannot be stabilized except by the introduction of some new currency. And this is what's happened in the past.
What would they do then? What would they do to balance this out again worldwide?
Oh, well, there's going to be no balance. I mean, there's going to be terrific losses, all right, obviously. And they're going to use that as the basis for creating some international currency, let's call it global currency unit, some new global currency unit. And they will introduce this. Some people are talking about the special drawing rights of the International Monetary Fund, and there are other various arguments that are made for this, that, and the other, whatever it is. And they will use that to substitute for, under some formula, a certain amount of foreign currency. So the Federal Reserve note currency that's out there will be reduced by 100,000, and we'll get a small number of these new stable units. This is what they've done again and again. Remember, the Federal Reserve System was done to do this for the unstable national banking system that existed from 1862 to 1913.
And it just called them over a problem. Well, how about, will they use Bitcoin?
Well, Bitcoin is this artificial thing which is really uncontrollable by anybody. It goes up and down. It swings back and forth. There's no absolute unit. I can't take a big piece of Bitcoin anywhere and get a fixed unit of anything.
Right.
That was the beauty of the constitutional system. There was a fixed unit tied to the real world. A piece of gold, a piece of silver with a stamp on it from the Treasury that said, this is how much is in this piece, is in this coin. And that was the thing that I could always get back to when dealing with the market, when dealing with the treasury, when dealing with the banks. Everyone returned to this central point where the XY axis crosses, in a sense, on the graph, the zero point. Right? Bitcoin has no zero point. None of these fictional currencies have a zero point. They're the ultimate in fiat money.
Uh-huh. That's what. Well,
so
I don't
trust them. I don't trust the technology because the technology can be manipulated in all sorts of ways. But it's not tied back to an actual amount of a real commodity. It has no reality in that sense.
Wow.
It's fictional money.
Well, folks. This has been powerful. We're down about the last 2 minutes. I've enjoyed this. I'm sure a lot of people, other than myself, have got somewhat of an education on a lot of things here. So what you're saying then basically is this system is going to collapse, no doubt about it. It's just a matter of how and when, right?
Yes.
Okay.
They're trying to make it a controlled collapse. Right? They don't want this to get out of hand because all sorts of political complications can arise. So they want to be able to control the collapse, kind of an implosion that has limitations on how fast and how far it can go. But I don't think that's going to work.
I don't see it working either, not this stage of the game. How can people email you different things, ask questions, or do you do that as normal policy? How do you keep in touch with people other than doing lectures like this?
Well, yeah, my address is at my News with Views column. Every one of my columns has the address at the base, newswithviews.com.
Okay.
You can find a lot of material there, including material on the banking system, Federal Reserve System. If they have questions, sure.
All right, folks,
I would say the main thing to do
say.
Is, first place, they've got to go out and study this system on their own. Too many people come to me with questions where I realize they're thinking at a very low. I mean, it's like arithmetic or mathematics. You know, they're dealing with first grade or second grade arithmetic, and we've got a problem that's in college calculus.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's very true. Yes. Yes. This has been phenomenal, Edwin, and I want to thank you. We're down in the last minute, so I just want to thank you for joining us tonight and sharing this. I hope people have enjoyed it as much as I have, because I've learned a lot, and I think they have, too. But thank you for taking your time out of your evening to do this. We really do appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure to do it, whenever I can help you.
Maybe we'll talk again sometime in the future. God bless you, my
sure.
friend, for being there. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. All right,
folks, what can I say? That was phenomenal. Phenomenal. An hour's worth of education and more than you're going to learn anywhere in any public school system today. Tomorrow night, we'll have Deborah Tavares on with you. You won't miss that, I'm sure. Have a wonderful evening, and I'll see you tomorrow night. Good night.
Get on the battlefield. Satan's armies come to kill. This is war. Satan's army roams the land.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.